Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 18th of June, these are our main stories. Is President Donald Trump going to face an impeachment trial? US lawmakers will decide in the coming hours. Poland's Supreme Court warns the government that proposed justice system reforms could threaten the country's membership of the EU. And scientists in Denmark sequence the genetic code of a Stone Age woman using a piece of ancient chewing gum. Also in this podcast.
They keep the shape, the oval shape of the boat. So actually we think that the boat went down slowly all the way down to the sea floor.
Thousands of terracotta pots that are telling the tale of an ancient shipwreck. We begin this podcast in the United States, where it's been a busy 24 hours, as ever, in Washington. And impeachment is the dominant topic. President Donald Trump has sent a letter to the ranking Democrat in Congress, Nancy Pelosi, saying the impeachment process had brought pain and suffering to the country. Mr. Trump compared his treatment to that of the victims of the 17th century Salem witch trials. He also told reporters that the allegations against him had been fabricated.
This has been a total sham from the beginning. Everybody knows it. I've never seen the Republican Party so united. We got our last vote, as you know, we got 100% of the vote. I watched numerous people last night, senators, and I think we're equally well united. They know it's a hoax, it's a witch hunt, and it's just a continuation. It's been going on now for almost 3 years, and it probably started before I even won the election.
Congress will vote on Wednesday on whether to impeach Donald Trump over his alleged attempt to get Ukraine to dish dirt on one of his potential rivals for the 2020 election. But Democrats in districts where there is a strong Republican presence are coming under intense pressure not to back the move. Donald Trump would become only the third US president to be impeached. If he is, there'll be a trial in the Senate in the new year, and he could be removed from office. Our North America editor, John Sopel in Michigan, sent us some reaction from the ground.
Oh, say, can you see?
In America, even a bog-standard town hall meeting like this one in Michigan comes wrapped in the stars and stripes. But over the impeachment of Donald Trump, it's a disunited States. And the congressmen and women who'll vote on this are under acute pressure from their voters.
Thank you.
None is feeling the heat more so than Alyssa Slotkin. She's a Democrat who won her seat last year in a wealthy district 30 miles north of Detroit. And she was struggling to make her voice heard.
Okay, so I'm just going to continue because I got the mic. Folks, these are the questions you're shouting at me, so you may want to just listen for one sec to the answer.
Take a breath.
You just have your stop.
One of those hecklers is Bill Rowerdink. He's come with a group of Republicans to stir things up. I spoke to him in the cafeteria afterwards.
You were there calling her out. What do you think the political consequences are for this congresswoman in this strongly Republican area?
Well, I think her self-awareness, self-perception is very good. She said, this vote may end my short-lived political career. I think that's really good self-assessment, because in a district that voted 7% for Trump, when she votes against Trump, that's a tough vote. So she may be ex-Congresswoman Slotkin.
But the congresswoman says there are some issues where you just have to make a stand.
When it comes to something like asking foreigners to intervene and get engaged here at home, that to me requires a response. It can't become normal to just reach out to foreigners. And I know it sounds different, but there just has to be some decisions that are beyond the political calculus. And it may be that voters decide in 2020 that they don't want me as their representative. I hope that's not the case. I really do.
The carol singers are out in Rochester, Michigan, and in fine voice. But they're being outshone, literally, by the astonishing Christmas lights on all the buildings along Main Street. Each shop is a block of one colour, reds, purples, yellows and blues. Understandably, there are other preoccupations at this time of year, though, like present buying and who's paying the electricity bill for the light show in the town. But impeachment too.
What do you think of the move to impeach him?
I think it's ridiculous. They're wasting a lot of taxpayers' money.
At this point, leave it to the voters. It's close enough.
The economy is doing phenomenally well.
He's the most corrupt man who's ever served in that office. He's exactly what the founding fathers intended when they came up with the idea of impeachment.
He's not fit for office. He's embarrassing.
In the midterm elections last year, Democrats gained a lot of Republican seats by promising to fix the roads and improve local schools. The focus on bread and butter, kitchen table issues was deliberate. But now Democrats will vote to impeach the president, with uncertain consequences. It's perfectly possible that the biggest casualties from the impeachment process could be the Democratic Party itself.
John Sopel. Now to India, where nationwide protests are continuing as anger grows over a controversial citizenship law. The legislation makes it easier for those fleeing persecution from three neighbouring Muslim-majority countries to get Indian citizenship. But Muslims are not eligible. Protesters claim this is in violation of India's secular values that provide people of all religions with equal rights. Priyanka Dubey is in the capital, Delhi, and she told us more about what was happening there.
In the first half of the day, the city was calm. But suddenly, as we moved towards afternoon, a fresh series of protests broke out in the eastern part of Delhi. The neighborhood I'm talking about is Seelampur. It's a Muslim-dominated area. And sudden, huge, violent protests broke out in the city. Some loss of public property has been reported. Details are not clear, but the Delhi chief minister came out requesting people to remain calm and not take law in their hands.
And you have been traveling around northern India. What have you seen in places outside Delhi?
That's right. I was in the Aligarh town of Uttar Pradesh yesterday. Now, Aligarh is another university town which has been majorly attacked and has been in news since the protest took place in Jamia on Sunday evening. So right after the protests took place in the Jamia University in Delhi, news which was not confirmed, an unconfirmed news that a casualty has happened in Jamia, this piece of news, it reached the Aligarh town and it created a sense of panic in that university town as well. Students got agitated and a fresh series of protests was called out. What I got to know during my reporting was that students in a march, they started walking towards the main university gate, and then there was a clash between the police and the students. Everyone has a separate version of events from here onwards. But I spoke to the doctors in that university town. There's a hospital also, and the doctors said that they treated at least 80 patients in a span of 3 to 4 hours, and all of them were students. Three of them have been majorly injured. One student also lost a limb. His hand has been amputated. But on the police's side, when I spoke to the police officials, they told me that they had in fact used restraint. And they're accusing the students. They said that the students were involved in immense stone pelting and they had to resort to using force. But the most important point here is that for the first time in the history of Aligarh Muslim University, police force actually went inside to the library, to the hostels. I've seen from my own eyes tear shells inside hostel rooms, and students are complaining that they were picked up, they were thrashed, and then they were detained. Officially, the figure of detained students is 21 as of now. There's a palpable amount of distress, anxiety, and the fear of unknown. The new or fresh orders say that all students are required to vacate the hostels and leave the university campus and go back to their homes as soon as they can.
Priyanka Dubey. Given the number of catastrophic environmental stories that we regularly feature in this podcast, you might be surprised to learn that scientists are still cataloguing around 2,000 new varieties of plants every year. This year's entries by the Royal Botanic Gardens here in London include a waterfall orchid and a miracle berry. Dr. Martin Cheek, a botanist at Kew Gardens, told Martha Carney that one of the discoveries wasn't actually made by a scientist, but a plant lover.
This was a Turkish paediatrician who, while on holiday one weekend, spotted an unusual snowdrop, took photos of it, put it up on Facebook, and a Ukrainian snowdrop fanatic going through Facebook found pictures of this, realised they were something extremely unusual, and contacted her, went out with her to re-find these plants, collect samples, and then brought this to the attention of one of my colleagues at Kew, Aaron Davis, who's a snowdrop specialist.
You're going to be bombarded with holiday pictures now. But tell us about your own discovery, the so-called waterfall orchid.
This is a plant that I collected last year in Guinea, a country in West Africa. And there's a whole family of plants that just grow in waterfalls. They need pure water, aerated rock to grow on. And many of them are highly localised. So having found out about this waterfall and being in Guinea as part of our Tropical Important Plant Areas programme, I get there and find out what species of this family were there. And in the course of that, I found this plant, which is only known from this waterfall. And the trouble it faces is that there's a hydroelectric dam planned for this site. And if that goes ahead, if no measures are taken, the risks are that this species will become extinct.
And that is a problem with many of the new species that you've discovered, that they are at risk of extinction, but many of them have really interesting medicinal properties.
Some of them do. Most plant species on the planet have not been even looked at for their potential applications for mankind, medicinal or otherwise.
But there's a fungus that you found which could be useful for arthritis?
That's right. And more than that, apparently this fungus from China, which uniquely grows on one species of bamboo in southwest China, in Yunnan, the fruit bodies have compounds of a class called hypocrelins, which have very high biological activity, including those you've mentioned, but also as antibiotics with many other medical applications. There's a lot of excitement in this class of compounds that are produced by this fungus.
Botanist Dr. Martin Cheek. Moving from new findings to old ones and a remarkable shipwreck dating back more than 2,000 years to the Roman Empire. It's a wreck without a ship. The boat itself disintegrated long ago, but what's left is the cargo, thousands of terracotta pots lying on the seabed near the Greek island of Kefalonia. George Ferentinos from the University of Patras in Greece led the study and spoke to John Donison.
The shipwreck, first of all, at present lies about a kilometre or half a mile from the present-day small fishing port Fiscardo. The boat is dated something between 1st century BC and 1st century AD. We cannot date it any more precise because the dating is based on the amphora. So this amphora, probably this type of amphora, were used for about 100 or 200 years of that time.
I've seen the photograph of this shipwreck. And it's remarkable because there's no ship, the ship's all disappeared, but you have these 6,000 amphorae, these pots, all lying on the seabed, forming the shape of a ship.
Yes, actually, the surface layer, you can see only the surface layer of the amphorae or of the pots, as you call them, which actually, if you count one by one, is about 1,000. And they are in very good condition. And they keep, as you said, the shape, the oval shape of the boat. So actually, we think that the boat went down, let's say, not during a storm, but probably just something happens and went down slowly, slowly, all the way down to the sea floor.
And would you be able to work out what was in these pots?
By scratching the inside of the pot and then using DNA techniques, you will find that what they were carrying. Okay, the usual thing that this amphora carries are either wine or olive oil or barley and wheat. And sometimes the Romans liked a sauce made from sardines, a kind of sauce called garum in Latin.
Mm.
Tasty. Very popular at that time. It was like the present-day ketchup, I would
say. Yeah, and would there be any attempt to bring these things to the surface at any time?
To bring a few of the amphorae and exhibit them, it's quite easy. It's not difficult and can be done, quite easy. But if you want to go under the amphorae and to find what was below them is quite expensive and costly, very expensive actually. And then if you think that there is the frame to bring it up, it's again more expensive. Now, the usual ships of that period was between 15 and 20 meters. It's the first, the largest boat found up to date in Eastern Mediterranean, and the fourth found all over Mediterranean of the same period.
Dr. George Farantinos from the University of Patras. Still to come in this podcast.
Legend tells of a ring created by an ancient evil that gave its wearer the power to enslave the world.
Want to be part of the Lord of the Rings universe? According to a new advert, you don't need to look like Orlando Bloom. The Supreme Court in Poland has said a bill which would make it easier for the government to sack judges is an infringement of EU treaties, and even that it could eventually lead to the country leaving the European Union. Adam Easton reports from Warsaw.
The European Commission would likely start legal action against Poland if the proposals are enacted, the Supreme Court said. The court has already ruled that the National Council of the Judiciary is no longer independent, since Law and Justice began appointing its members in early 2018. Under the proposals, judges who question the legitimacy of their peers selected by the new council could face a fine or even dismissal.
Adam Easton. Is it really too late to save the historic city of Venice? Officials have been building and repairing flood defences for decades, but last month high tides caused devastating damage to the ancient city. So, is it time to give up? Our Italy correspondent Mark Lowen has been trying to find out.
Welcome to MOSE. MOSE means Experimental Electromechanical Module.
Monica Ambrosini works on one of Italy's most ambitious and controversial engineering projects in its history, the MOSE floodgate system, barriers built at the three inlets to the Venice Lagoon to protect it from acqua alta, or high tides.
When we have to raise up the gates, we pump air through this pipe so they raise up, floating. Then, when it's finished, the event of high tide, we extract the air through that pipe so they lower down in their initial position.
This underground tunnel, 12 metres below the sea level, feels like it goes on forever. It's 420 metres long, flanked by cables, pipes and wires. Construction began 16 years ago. It was due to finish in 2014, but that's now been pushed back to 2022. And it's been a den of legal problems. 35 people were arrested for corruption in relation to the project, including the former mayor of Venice.
The problem is that the Italian government considers MOSE too big to fail.
Marco Baravalle is an anti-MOSE activist. Why does he see the project as the problem, not the solution?
These parts, even if the MOSE is not yet working, are already totally rusted and destroyed. Then there are some financial objections concerning the maintenance. And then, last but not least, there are like climate change issues, because the raising of the sea level would totally take out of the game a system like MOSE, which is very old in terms of design.
St. Mark's Square, Venice's tourist heart, bore the brunt of the floods, and inside the Byzantine Basilica, the damage is clear. The floodwater reached the 13th century mosaic floor of the basilica. I'm standing in front of one part here which shows two peacocks, and they've had to be covered with a sort of fabric gauze because the individual stones of the mosaic were ripped away by the force of the water.
Venezia che muore. Venezia appoggiata sul mare.
For 1,000 years, the sea made Venice the heart of a powerful empire. Now, in just 100 years, projections say the city could sink. MOSE's floodgates may stop that. At stake, whether Venice survives or becomes just an underwater theme park.
Mark Lowen reporting from Venice. The global gender gap, that's the difference between male and female salaries, is on the way to disappearing, according to the global think tank, the World Economic Forum. but not quite yet. In fact, on current trends, salaries around the world will only really reach equality in about 100 years from now. Dan Damon spoke to the report's author, Sadia Zahidi.
So we look at four different areas. We look at health, education, economic participation, and political empowerment. And it's that combination and the trend that's occurring over the last 14 years since we've been doing this that leads us to predict that it may take 99 years at the current pace of change. But the trends across those four different areas still look vastly different.
And I suppose the indication is that things are getting better, but they couldn't get much worse, could they? And obviously it's ridiculous that this is a 100-year project. So what's to be done?
I mean, here we are at the dawn of the 2020s, and according to the Sustainable Development Goals, one of which focuses on gender equality, we have 10 years left to get there globally. So how do we move from 100 years to 10 years? And we're finding that there are a few areas that must be focused on. One is the care infrastructure. Caregiving responsibilities are still primarily the domain of women across most societies. Even in some of the most gender equal countries in the world, women are doing about twice the amount of housework and caregiving that men are doing. So there has to be better balance and, frankly, better care infrastructure provided by policymakers to women and men alike, especially as we look at the families of tomorrow that will not have the same structures as the families of today. A second aspect is when it comes to the roles that are being automated in the context of the technological changes we're seeing today, it's become very clear that it's not just male blue-collar workers that are being displaced. It's also a lot of women that are in services, customer service roles and administrative assistant roles. These happen to be roles that have given a lot of women middle-class livelihoods over the last couple of decades. And if we're going to focus on reskilling and upskilling these people into new roles, then there has to be a focus on all of this with a gender lens. And then finally, the third aspect is, if you look at the growing roles of the future, so we looked at eight different professions that are growing. In six of them, women make up the minority, especially if you look at cloud computing, only 12% of the talent is female. If you look at engineering, only 15% of the talent is female. This means we're going to have to put in place corrective measures to build the right kind of pipeline and also ensure that organizations are then bringing those women in. We found that even when there is talent, most organizations are failing to actually bring that talent in, which is surprising given that these are some of the most in-demand skills of the future.
Sadia Zahidi from the World Economic Forum. Now to an extraordinary science story about DNA, chewing gum, and the genetic code. Our Europe Desk editor Danny Eberhardt is something of an expert.
Well, this is really remarkable. They've found this bit of birch pitch, which is a kind of like a tar. It's basically made from when you heat up birch bark, and it's thousands of years old. And trapped inside this birch pitch, they've found enough human DNA, well preserved, extremely well preserved apparently, to sequence the entire human genome, which is the first time apparently it's been done from anything other than things like bones. So the scientists from the University of Copenhagen and their colleagues are very excited about this finding, and it has drawn this incredible picture of the person who they believe chewed this bit of birch bark.
And it is an arresting picture, eyes staring back at me from the BBC website, the news story. What do we know about her?
Well, this is, it was a female, this person, a woman or a girl, and she's believed to, she's got light eyes, blue eyes, dark brown hair, and a darkish skin. So she's, they believe that she's a hunter-gatherer. They think she's more closely related to the hunter-gatherers of Central Europe than a different group of hunter-gatherers that were in central Scandinavia at the time. This was a piece of birch bark was found in southern Denmark in an archaeological dig. She is also, really fascinatingly, they've found a whole load of other traces of DNA, some of which show what were the microbes that were in her mouth at the time, and some of the pathogens, the things like the viruses that she was carrying. They've got traces of a thing called Epstein-Barr virus, which is sometimes linked to glandular fever. And then even more remarkably, they found traces of what she may have eaten just before she chewed this bit of birch tar. And those were hazelnuts and duck, they reckon, mallard duck. So this is not the scientist, this is me. Maybe it was used as a kind of a mouth cleanser, like an ancient after-dinner mint or something like that.
Danny Eberhardt talking to Divya Iyer. There aren't enough ugly people in New Zealand, apparently. That's the conclusion of casting agencies working on a new TV series based on the Lord of the Rings trilogy. Richard Hamilton reports.
Legend tells of a ring created by an ancient evil that gave its wearer the power to enslave the world.
The trailer for the original film series of Lord of the Rings. Now Amazon is bringing out a multi-million dollar TV series based on Tolkien's epic trilogy. But casting agencies in New Zealand looking for would-be orcs, trolls, elves and hobbits have had trouble finding enough suitably flawed faces in the nation of under 5 million people, so they're casting their net further afield. One company in Auckland, where else, has issued an appeal on Facebook for people who are either under 1.5 metres or over 2 metres tall. The advert goes on to say that they must be those with character faces, wrinkles, as well as hairy people of all ages and ethnicities. Finding extras before filming starts next year with specific traits would help save on the costs of makeup, wigs and special effects. Extras in New Zealand can earn about $200 a day and get fed on the job.
A man with a perfect face for a podcast, Richard Hamilton. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.
By listening first, strategizing second, and collaborating constantly, MetLife Investment Management takes a client-first approach to institutional investing. With expertise in public fixed income, private capital, and real estate, we are institutional, but far from typical. Learn more at MetLife.com/institutional. That's MetLife.com/institutional.